Hello, this is Mike Keyes with ID the Future, and we have again with us today Paul Nelson, who is a philosopher of biology and really a theoretical biologist. Paul, is it okay if I call you a theoretical biologist? Because as I read your work, I mean, that's what you do much of the time.
It's okay with me. I'll have to tell you a funny story. In 1999, I was in China, southern China, for a conference on the evolution of body plans. And the late Eric Davidson was there. He was a developmental biologist at Caltech. He and his lab single-handedly really developed the technology to understand the genome and development of the purple sea urchin and made it a model system in developmental biology. Anyway, Davidson was there. We got to know each other a little bit. And after I gave my talk, which generated a lot of discussion,
I'm sure
he said to me, pretty good talk, Paul, for someone who's not a biologist. So, I confronted him later and said, well, what would it take? And he said, spend 2 years in somebody's lab, which I've never done, but I really am a frustrated biologist. I think I ended up as a philosopher because I could get a fellowship being a crazy philosopher.
But, you know, Paul, coming to this sort of, you know, banter between professionals about, you know, territory, and sometimes as a historian and philosopher of science, I've seen this happen over and over again. And so, I mean, there have been theoreticians in various fields who don't spend time in the lab or don't have a telescope, but they think about the tough questions that then people go out and test in the field or in the lab or through observations of remote objects in the night sky. So, I mean, isn't there sort of a symbiotic relationship here? I mean, we all need each other to make science work. Wouldn't you agree with that?
I would completely. And I think the disciplinary boundaries are necessary in the sense that you need to get the proper training, but they can also be an obstacle. And I would say that history ends up sorting it out, and truth is justified by all her children. You know, I'm happy to accept the teasing or the, call it what you will, of Eric Davidson if I can get Professor Davidson to think differently about some of the questions in front of him. So I know that my interactions with biologists have throughout my life have been enormously fruitful, and they often bring philosophical questions to me that I haven't considered. So yes, we need to have disciplinary training, disciplinary boundaries, but we also need to have these fields cross-pollinating, and we need to accept truth and tough questions wherever we find them.
You know, it would be great if there was a large book that would integrate scientific, philosophical, and even a little bit of theology when it comes to the question of theistic evolution. And there is such a book, and Paul, you're in it several times, I think, three essays to be exact. So we already, earlier in another show, we talked about your five questions everyone should ask about common descent. And now let's take a peek at your essay, co-authored with Steve Meyer, entitled "Should Theistic Evolution Depend on Methodological Naturalism?" Now, this is not in the scientific section of the book; it's in the philosophical section of the book. Talk to us about that placement. How is methodological naturalism a philosophical question regarding evolution and really origin science in general?
I think one of the easiest ways to understand the role of this principle, and you know, it's multisyllabic. I counted the syllables once. I think there are 10 of them. Methodological naturalism, you can tick those off on your fingers, the syllables, simply means that when a scientist is doing science, when he or she goes into the lab and puts their eye to the lens of a microscope or goes out in the field to look at some make observations, gather data, and so forth, that in that capacity and when they're theorizing, they must use a toolkit of explanation of causes, principles, call it what you will, that is limited to the natural, where natural means physical. In other words, deriving from the bottommost layer of reality, which is to use the ancient Greek phrase, particles in motion, right?
Right.
There's no intellect, no mind, no teleological principles of purpose and so forth. These are all, on this view, late arriving consequences of an evolutionary development from the Big Bang to the present, where the main actors in terms of scientific explanation, and really the only actors in terms of scientific explanation, are non-mental, non-intentional, physical, and material states.
Hopefully, okay? Hopefully, Paul, the scientist who is using methodological naturalism, is himself or herself an actual mental agent who can think about the world. But yeah, they're thinking about earlier history, perhaps when those entities didn't exist, or at least they posit that they didn't exist.
That's right. And Steve and I, in our chapter, we open with a sports metaphor to help the reader see this. So I'm old enough to remember the NBA before the three-point shot. So before 1979, a field goal from anywhere on the court, doesn't matter how close or how far you were from the net, from the hoop, a field goal yielded 2 points. Well, in 1979, the NBA made an executive decision that for a variety of reasons, but mostly to make the game more interesting, they would put an arc on the floor 23 feet and 9 inches from the hoop. If you stood at that arc or beyond it, you'd get 3 points. And of course, the reason for putting that there is a long, beautiful shot like that is risky, right? And you need to give a player some motivation for even trying it. But we like to see those shots. They're elegant and beautiful. So you make a shot from that point, you get 3 points, right?
So like every field, every sport has some kind of reward structure where players who obey the rules get goodies, right?
Well, I think yes. I mean, and we in sports. I'm also an ice hockey fan. The organizations that govern the sport are constantly shifting the rules to make the game better. So the NHL, professional ice hockey in the 80s was really boring, I thought. I was a fan. There was a lot of holding. You could only pass the puck at a certain distance on the ice. That rule has been changed. You can now make two-line passes, and that is much more exciting. Holding has been cut way down.
But wasn't there still a lot of fighting back then, too? Made it exciting?
There was a lot of fighting. There's less fighting now. There's less a lot less fighting now. So we point out in the chapter that science, like sports, is something that we do. It has not been delivered to us. And we, meaning humans, make the rules, make the conventions, and adopt them. And we can change them. And this is true in science as well. The rules of science can change, because over the course or can be changed, because that's actually happened over the course of scientific history. So we say in the chapter to the reader, why adopt this rule of methodological naturalism, especially if you're a theist or a Christian?
Oh, by the way, Paul, you know, it just occurred to me about changing rules in science, scientists get rewarded by obeying certain rules. But as a historian of science, one of the things that I enjoy doing is discovering when the rules change and ask, why do they change? Because that gives me a reward as a historian and philosopher of science. And it sounds like you have a common desire to understand that, because it helps us to understand how science has worked and how it does work.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And when I'm interacting with a scientist, he or she says, well, I can't really entertain that idea. There are a couple of reasons that they might say that, at least two. One is, I can't entertain that because the evidence is against it. Mm-hmm. That to me would be the most powerful, right? Nature just doesn't work that way, or the evidence that we have is incongruent with that hypothesis. They might say it, however, for another reason, and that kind of hypothesis has been ruled out, or that kind of hypothesis is beyond the pale of what's rational. Now, there, I want to say, how do you know? right? In physics, when we go back to the time of Newton, for instance, action at a distance, in other words, force being extended through empty space between two or more bodies, was thought to be physically impossible. All physical change seemed to require direct interaction of material bodies, like one billiard ball bumping another. But how, a skeptic of action at distance would ask, how could you possibly have two billiard balls on a table that are affecting each other with no physical contact between them?
Right.
But along comes Newton, looks at the solar system, and he says, these bodies, the sun and the earth, for instance, appear to be affecting each other with no direct material interaction between the two bodies. And let me construct a theory where I suspend the requirement for physical interaction and allow for action at a distance, just to see what would follow from that. And you end up having Newtonian mechanics, which is very powerful and explanatory, works, has mathematical structure. You can use it to predict all kinds of things.
But, so, you know, Paul, at that time, there were many scientists who said, Newton, you're not doing science. This is not science at all. Does that sound familiar?
It does sound very familiar. And I want to encourage scientists to ask the hard questions about these foundational assumptions that they make. Now, some of those assumptions may be well justified and they may want to hang on to them. But in the case of methodological naturalism, I think the rule doesn't give you anything that science can't provide for itself. And that's especially true for theists or Christians whose view of reality as a whole extends well beyond the physical, right? Well beyond the material. The world, meaning everything that there is, both material and immaterial, is not exhausted by particles in motion. The very fact that we're doing this podcast, for instance, reflects your goals, my desires, your desires, those of Discovery Institute, those of the intelligent design research community at large, and so forth. A whole bunch of mental constructs that it's question begging to say have some physical correlate. And I think that methodological naturalism is a ground rule for science that actually harms science, because it limits the options of the investigator to consider what might be true about the universe.
Can you give us an example of this limitation that you're talking about?
Sure. Let me talk about a part of biology that I absolutely love, and that's development. Going from a fertilized egg to a newly hatched, let's say, worm, to a sexually mature worm that's capable of making more little worms and so forth. All right. So C. elegans, Caenorhabditis elegans, is a nematode with about 1,000 cells in the adult. It's very well studied. All of its DNA has been mapped. But even before that was done, John Sulston and his colleagues in the UK sat at special microscopes and watched these worms develop year in, year out, carefully mapping which cells were dividing to give rise to which cells, starting with a fertilized egg all the way to hatching and then to the sexually mature adult worms.
Wow, what a project. That sounds comprehensive.
Oh, it is just a gold standard of observational biology, of incredible meticulous patience to map out this process. And one of the things they discovered, which of course they knew in one sense going in, but really their observations affirmed, is that development in C. elegans is end-directed. In other words, when that single cell, the fertilized egg, begins to divide, the daughter lineages that come off of that division know where they're going. In other words, you start with one cell to two to four to eight and so forth. As these lineages are dividing, the trajectories that they're setting up, are heading towards functional tissues in the newly hatched worm and eventually in the adult, such that right at the first division, the germline comes off, right? It is immediately separated from all the other cells. The germline will give rise to the sperm and ovaries that will carry the instruction set to do it again. In other words, to make it possible to have offspring, to do the whole thing over again. Those instructions are immediately isolated from the rest of the dividing cells. They go off and become the ovaries and the sperm and so forth. Another group of cells become the gut. Another group of cells become the skin or the cuticle. Another group of cells become the nervous system. This process is end-directed. In other words, it's aiming towards a distant target.
Hey, you know, I was just thinking, you're giving an example of how methodological naturalism can be limiting. And you're setting this up, and you're the things that you're saying are themselves indirected. You're at the in less than 60 seconds, I bet you're going to bring this down to the point of saying, and see, here's an example of how methodological naturalism is limiting. So you're, this very conversation is indirected, isn't it? It's aimed at something. You're giving details about little organisms that people don't know about. You're setting it up to see something important. Go on.
No, you're right. I mean, this is happening both as a biological example, but also the philosophical point I'm making is end-directed, namely that whatever cause established this pattern, knew or could aim at the outcome before the outcome itself existed. You can see this with C. elegans itself as you work your way back down these lineages towards the starting point. Some process, some mechanism, some cause had to set up these cell divisions in such a way that they would produce a functional organism at the other end. The only kind of cause we know that can do that is intelligence, because evolution by natural selection has no foresight. In our other conversation dealing with principle of continuity, we talked about this rule, and one of the sub-rules under continuity is that evolution has no foresight. It doesn't know where it's going. Blind, undirected processes, by definition, don't know where they're going. But whatever cause set up cell division in C. elegans, which is really a very, very simple system relative to what we see, for instance, in human embryos or human development, we're vastly more complicated. Although, strikingly, we have about the same number of proteins as C. elegans does. Whatever cause set that up had to know where the target was and how to hit it.
That sounds like we're breaking the rule of only unguided naturalistic processes can explain the phenomena we see.
We are breaking it, and we're breaking it for a very good reason. We're breaking it because the evidence seems to call for us to break it.
Sounds like nature's talking back.
nature's talking back, and nature is saying, you've got this rule that you've adopted philosophically. I didn't give it to you. You adopted it. And it is a ball and chain attached to your ankle that is preventing you from understanding really how C. elegans came to be. So one of the things I hope to do this year in 2018 is develop this point in more detail in a way that I can take the case to the people working in the field called EvoDevo, which is the intersection between evolutionary biology and developmental biology, and say, if you ever hope to understand these teleological, and that's what they are, going back to the Greek root telos, mm-hmm. end or goal, these teleological processes of development, if you ever hope really to understand them, you're going to have to think very seriously about the limits that methodological naturalism places on your freedom as an investigator. And here's the thing that I want the Christians in the listening audience and the theists in the listening audience, some of whom may accept theistic evolution, here's what I really want them to hear. Methodological naturalism as a governing rule can only take things away from you. Hmm. Okay? Think about it this way. Every natural regularity, every functional principle, every physical law that God put in the creation that we have yet to discover is still there awaiting for us to find it. So if we let go of methodological naturalism, all of that will still be there. But we now have the freedom to consider intelligence or mind as a cause, and intelligence or mind can bring about effects that are unique to intelligence and mind, such as foresight or end-directed relationships or causes. So you can think about this like you're a metaphor that I've used for years is you go to an island to dig for treasure. Methodological naturalism creates no dig zones. It puts up impenetrable barriers over parts of that island where you're simply not allowed to go. I want to take down those barriers and say, what can we find over there, knowing that I'll still have the whole rest of the island to search. So this kind of asymmetry between a science that adopts naturalism versus a science that lets it go is very powerful. And if I can get a scientist or just a curious human being to see that methodological naturalism is limiting their freedom, I'm halfway there. Because even if I were an atheist or an agnostic, I would not want any limits on my intellectual freedom to investigate the world that's out there. I want the world to be as surprising and interesting as it actually is.
And indeed, the world is very surprising and interesting, as are you also, Paul. Every time I speak with you, I'm surprised at something else I'm discovering. But, you know, while you're, since we need to bring this to a close here, 2018 is just beginning, and your work that you just described sounds very exciting. Now, I want to assign some homework for the listeners to be working on while you're working on your next project, and that is to go to Amazon or your other online book supplier and just simply do a search for Theistic Evolution, and you'll probably, near the top, find this title, Theistic Evolution, A Scientific, Philosophical, and Theological Critique with Crossway Books. Paul Nelson appears multiple times in the book, and you have more to look forward to in the future as Paul's research as a philosopher of biology and, as I like to call him, theoretical biologist, continues. Thank you, Paul, so much for being on the program today with us.
I always enjoy having my say, and the problem is you can't shut me up, so you have to bring the program. I'd just be yakking for hours, unfortunately.
Well, it is an indirected process, and part of the end is to at some point say, well, we'll bring you back another time to pick up this other thread. Thanks again, yeah. Paul, for being with us.
I really enjoyed it.
All right, bye-bye.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.